History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. They don't have to go untold if we're willing to do something about it before it's too late. Our aim is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we're always educated, we're always entertained, and often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks 84 years since that day of infamy when more than 2,400 Americans stationed on and around the island of Oahu were killed in that surprise attack by Imperial Japan. Commemorations are taking place at Pearl Harbor, at the National World War II Memorial, and in communities all over America, trying to uphold the motto of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association: Remember Pearl Harbor, Keep America Alert. We're going to hear about that fateful day today from men who experienced it firsthand, their memories enduring even after their days on Earth have ceased. We're going to start with Delton Wally Walling. If you visit the Pearl Harbor Aviation Museum today on Ford Island, you can go up in the same observation tower where he witnessed that shocking and devastating panorama 84 years ago.
It's a beautiful day, and all at once, overhead, we've got planes, high planes, low planes, all coming in on us. Oh, must be a big maneuver today. Those orange balls up there is not ringing the bell yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ringing the bell even when we see those black objects dropping out of those planes.
It hasn't hit you yet that this is enemy.
That isn't it. Mm-hmm. And when the bomb went off on Fort Allen and all planes are exploding everywhere, we know we're in war.
And you saw that, clear as day.
I watch it all. I'm the only one that can tell you the Pearl Harbor story, and this is the reason why. I'm looking down on everything. You're on a ship, mm-hmm. and that ship gets hit by a torpedo or what? Who sees that? The ship itself. That's all. They can't see beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking down on everything. But remember this, you can't see it all at one time because everything's blowing up at one time.
Right.
So you can't even follow it.
Mm-hmm.
All you can just pick up in pieces. See?
Well, and that's what, you know, on this program over the years, I've heard from guys who are on a lot of different ships or on land while this is happening, and they have those little slivers of the puzzle that they saw from their perspective. And your perspective is intriguing, and what you're saying is you're the last guy left that was in that tower and looking from that spot where you could see each one of these things that's happening. You're, what, 19, 20 years old?
19.
What in the world was going through your head?
I'm froze to the rail because the first thing that happened just before the plane started dropping was Hickam Field is blowing up. It's right behind me. I'm looking, oh, maybe a couple minutes or something before the raid started right over Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So Hickam Field is destroyed immediately. Now I'm froze to that rail because I have joined the greatest Navy of all times. And here it is, being blown up in my face in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm devastated. Because if they can do that in 10 minutes, what else is coming?
Right.
And scuttlebutt is everywhere. They've already landed on the other side, and, oh, man, you don't know what to believe. The Arizona never blew up till 8:06. It's the last ship that blew up. Because your California sunk, Oklahoma's rolled over, the Utah's rolled over,
mm-hmm.
and the West Virginia's got hit by at least 7 torpedoes. It's a mess. It went straight down. We can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way of us doing a thing.
With thousands and thousands of military personnel on Oahu that day, there are so many different vantage points. And we get another one from a Kansas native who had actually traveled to Oahu aboard the USS Arizona. Eugene Leonard's assignment was working on planes at Eva Field, a Marine Corps air base west of Pearl Harbor. Did you have any idea before December 7th, was there any concern
that the Japanese might attack?
None at all. Absolutely surprised.
Tell me about that Sunday morning. What's the first thing you remember?
I remember the airplanes flying about, 8-10 miles away, coming in. They looked different, but they was tiny. You know, that's quite a ways away. And I could see torpedoes hanging halfway below the airplane. The nose would be pointed down from the airplane. That's what they used to sink the different ships.
So when you first saw the airplanes, did you think?
We discussed it. You know, all the guys, we stand college, you know, your mom. Yeah. But, hey, what's going on? Hey, them, they look different. And as soon as that's over, of course, I had to go to my guard station. And when we went to the guard station, when we was attacked for this base, see, this is the first airplane come over our way, attacked the truck that I was in.
When you first saw those planes, did you think they were American planes?
Oh, no. I could see that red thing.
Even when they were far away, though? I mean, when you saw them on the horizon?
I didn't know what there was when they were far away. We didn't know what there was.
So did it start to trigger maybe something's wrong here?
No, I really didn't know something was wrong at all until we got in the ring and that plane come after us. Then I knew something was wrong. We knew right then, but it's already too late. We didn't have anything to do.
So you and another guard are driving a truck. How big a truck?
Just a pickup with a flatbed.
So you don't have much protection?
No protection whatsoever.
And the very first plane that comes in that's firing
at that truck. They broke off from the battles. They was coming in from the north side of the island and across. And we could see them going across to Pearl Harbor. And you see, they just broke off. They had to get our airplanes too, you know.
Yeah.
And they broke off. Say they was Schofield Barracks and Wheeler Armor Air, all them. They was attacking them all at the same time.
And you guys at your field had, what, about 40 or 50 airplanes?
Well, there was three squadrons, and we only had about eight in our squadron. And then there's dive bombing, a fighter squadron, and another a scout bomber squadron.
And so some of those planes are planes that, had you guys been able to get them in the air, could have fought with the Japanese planes and inhibited the damage.
The rear gunners and all that would be after them, and the fighter planes and everything.
But they were able to destroy them all right there on the ground.
They destroyed them on the ground. No ammunition anywhere.
And they almost destroyed you. So your truck, the Japanese plane is firing machine gun bullets right at you. You got out of the truck. And
I got out of it, so did the other guy.
And you had an idea of where a safe place to go would be. Tell me what that was.
Well, that was the big building where the morning mask was, where the holes was in the ground.
So this Eva Field had been used in World War I with dirigibles, inflatable airships.
Right.
And so they had these big hangars, and there were holes ground.
There was no big hangars. There was no hangars whatsoever.
So what was the purpose of this building you were hiding in?
Well, it's just machinery to cables up and down for the tower.
But you knew that in that building, as kind of a leftover of the old technology, there were these big holes in the ground.
Right. There's just holes in the ground.
How big around were they?
Oh, it wasn't round. It was long, probably that wide.
4 or 5 feet?
4 feet, 5 feet long.
So you and the other guy run in there and jump in those holes?
He didn't follow me. No. I just went for the, I don't know where he went.
So you just knew that's a safe place to go?
I was trying to get away from the bullets is all I knew.
So you hopped down in this hole. Was there anything else in that hole?
No.
Nothing crawling on you?
Like I say, scorpions was all over the place, and was and spiders and all that. So that's about all that's around.
So you preferred a bug bite to a Japanese bullet?
I knew the holes were there. See, I was second in rank. The number one sergeant in rank was killed probably 75 feet from where I was at. He got out there, grabbed a fire extinguisher where the airplanes was, and he got shot.
Were you guys pretty defenseless at that point?
We was defenseless.
didn't have anti-aircraft guns or anything like that.
We didn't have anything, no ammunition or anything.
So the best thing you could have done is what you did, because there was nothing you were going to do to the Japanese. You just had to make sure you survived. What was it like to be in that hole, and what were you hearing? What was happening around you?
All I heard was the rattle of the building of the machine gun fire hitting it. I didn't know whatever. I just ducked down all I could in that to dodge everything. I happened to know that was there because it was right close to my work area, see. The airplanes that I worked on was right outside of that, right close to where I was at. But I just ducked down in the hole, see, because I happened to know they was there.
How long you think you were in the hole?
5, 10 minutes. I don't know. I have no idea. I was ducked down and trying to, you know, work as much safety. And as soon as that building stopped rattling, I run to the guardhouse to get my rifle and no ammunition, of course. And the truck took us, it'd come back to the guardhouse and took us to the ammunition sheds. And I got in there with a 45, broke the lock. And we loaded ammunition as fast as we could. They was in a cloth deal that full of 30-06 ammunition. And we was just that ammunition to people. Everyone was grabbing rifles, everything else. And, of course, then we got machine gun ammunition and all that. But, hey, the machine guns, the stands all broke up. We armed ourselves just as fast as we could, if ever we could, because we figured they was coming in for a landing, which they did not do.
Yeah, so you guys really weren't prepared for that initial attack, and then after that, you prepared, and nothing else happened.
We prepared for an attack by land troops, because that's the only thing we could do.
And the reason I asked you how long you were in the hole, and you said 5 or 10 minutes... Something tells me it felt like a lot longer than that.
I don't know, because it's not very long. It doesn't take very long to set the airplanes on fire. They're just sitting on the ground everywhere, lined up. Mm-hmm. And, hey, they could come down hitting them airplanes and fire. They got them on fire so fast you can't believe it, because it's all lined up.
What was going through your mind as you were in that hole?
I don't have any idea. It was just that I was trying to save myself. I didn't know what was going on except that I was being shot at.
When the building stopped rattling and you came out of there, what did you see? What was the scene around you?
Airplanes on fire. Just piles of planes are burning. All that fuel had to be burnt. See, it's burning everywhere.
One of the more unforgettable December 7th accounts we've heard here over the years came from a decorated pilot named Robert Thacker, who had taken off in his B-17 bomber from Northern California the night before and was landing at Hickam Field on Oahu on the morning of December 7th.
We had been up all night for 2 nights, no sleep. You're young, and you think you can have anything and do anything, so we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting 3-star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, oh, there's Doris Duke's home, we're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, oh, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian, and I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower, no answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, what do you know? Blah, blah, blah. No one said, come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, hell, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, a tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly that, bang, 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 all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days, you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I dropped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were three zeros jumped me. They shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around. And I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line. And I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial airdrop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line, and if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
We are so thankful we had that privilege. That was Robert Thacker. It's time for our first break, but there are more Pearl Harbor memories to come as we mark the 84th anniversary with only a handful of survivors now still living. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, focusing on Pearl Harbor today as we mark 84 years since that date which has lived in infamy. By the time we're done, we will have heard from seven different Pearl Harbor survivors on today's program. Joe Quercia was aboard the repair ship USS Medusa.
This kid that I joined the Navy with was Louis Gatewood. Louis and I just got done with breakfast that morning. We had our bunks down. I was leaning on my bunk, talking to him and his, and looking out the porthole at Ford Island, just right across from us. And I told him, I says, my God, Louis, I says, they're having gunnery practice this morning. I says, them planes are all painted with red spots on them. And about time I got done with that saying, GQ sounded, and they said, this is war. Well, hell, I never know anything about war or anything, you know, went to your battle stations. I was a topside sailor at that time. I didn't have too many years to service. Got to watch the whole thing from up topside. And there was one ship that went by, and the pilot was so close when he come down between the Curtis and us, and I gave him the finger. And maybe I shouldn't have done that. But you could see him in there just as clear as a bell, you know. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, I wonder if he'd turn around, come back, and try to shoot us, but he didn't. The Medusa had four or five-inch mounts, and all the firing equipment were at the base being worked on. They couldn't fire them. That's a service gun. And we had a three-inch anti-aircraft gun on topside on the deck up on topside, and that, we got credit for a two-man sub that came up between the Curtis and the Medusa. We put a shell through its conning tower. We got one plane, and when it crashed later on a day after, so after one of our guys went over there and cut off some tin, I got a piece of the metal off of it. The next day, they put me in the boats, you know, being I was down below deck in engineering to run the boat, then we had to go by and pick up them poor sailors that we found. We picked up three of them that next morning, and it still bothers me when I think about it. It's just so.
Was it like at the time for you? Were you numb to it, or was it a tough emotional thing at the time?
Well, when I thought about the guys and saw the Arizona, because we had to go by the Arizona, it was still smoking and all that, and seeing all them battleships sitting on there out in the bay, the Oklahoma was over, and then watching the Utah capsize, it did bother me then. And there was only 58 guys that got killed on the Utah, but the story goes, the one kid that jumped off in the ocean side in the bay area, and was swimming over to the Curtis, and I saw him coming, had the glasses on him. About the time he got to the Curtis, a kamikaze, one of them jets decided to crash on the fantail of the Curtis. And he proceeded to come to our gangplank and come up on a gangplank. I got talking to him. He was a machinist mate, first class petty officer. He said there was too much commotion on the Curtis, so he said, I just kept swimming, came over to our ship. And I don't know where it happened to him, but he stayed on because I got transferred off of it later on, you know, to come back for new construction. Mm-hmm. That was my time in there. The first bunch came over with fighters and torpedo bombers and two-man sub. They opened the gate, and I hear, I don't know how many of them two-man sub come in, but they're the ones that shot them torpedoes at them, probably out of the battle wagons that were laying on the side. And some of them the plane brought, you know, they had torpedoes on them. And then when the horizontal bombers come through, they made some that carried bombs, and that's the one that went over the Arizona. And when it went down through the armor deck and got into the magazine down and exploded, that's what caused that poor ship to go to hell. It just ripped it wide open, you know. And I thought they got the fuel docks because the smoke was so thick. Because we were just on the opposite side of Fort Island. Fort Island ain't very wide, but you could see over there, it was just blacker than coal, and thought, God, they must have got the oil, but they didn't. They just got the Arizona.
Have you been back there since?
I go back since? I was back there when my granddaughter got married. I took her back. I left her in 46, and I went back, and she got married over on Maui. And then I took my family over to the memorial, and it was loaded with people. And when it tied up, the skipper told everybody to stay aboard. I had my Pearl Harbor hat on, and he called me off and saluted the stern, and he says, now you can come off, let me off first. That was the only thing that I thought was real nice of him to do. And the fellow that I didn't know was killed. There was a buddy of mine who was on the vessel. His name is Harold Arnberg. He's from Madeira. And if you ever go there, right on the bottom of where all the men that was on Arizona, there's a little spot, six people that was on the vessel. Harold Arnberg, his name's the first one. He went through boot camp with me and everything. And I didn't know that he was killed until I saw that.
What was that like for you when you saw his name?
That kind of bothers you, you know, the thinking that you lost some of them. There might have been other people there because there was 150 in our company. How many was gone and how many are alive today? I don't know. You know, you don't keep tracks of them. You never know who they are. But that's the only one. And one thing I liked about Harold, he was tattoo happy. And I said, you don't want to go over Germany. I said, if they tell me them German generals, they catch a sailor or a soldier that's got a lot of tattoos, their wife skin them and make lamps out of them. And he told me, he said, I ain't never going to go to Germany. But anyway, Harold was killed that morning. And I don't know where he was on the vessel. They have him as a fireman. So he was a below deck sailor. So was I, a below deck sailor. All my time was done below the waterline when I was, until I made chief. Mm-hmm. And we don't get no submarine pay. But if a torpedo would come through a ship, it would knock us out first thing, you know, because most of the boiler rooms were below the waterline. But it didn't happen. I'm here, and I'm happy.
Me too. You saw the Utah go down?
Well, yeah, the Utah, it was a target ship. That's the one that they practice on. And she was, like I said, she came in where we tied up at our berth. And when she got torpedoed, seeing it turning, I thought it was going to, you know, finally explode. It's kind of funny feeling to see a big ship like that turn over sideways and just lay down like I was just a lazy log, you know. I just turned over, and then you could see the guys jumping off of it, you know, because I had glasses on and I could see.
You could see pretty close.
And most of them had gone towards Fort Island. See, they just jumped and got on. They only had to go maybe 20, 30 feet. They were on land. But the ones that went on the water side, then that's the way that one kid that was with us, he had to swim about, oh, I don't know, as long as a football field maybe, or shorter.
You saw it in a way that not many people did, as far as how close you could see.
Yeah, because you know the planes, people don't believe how many there was. There's supposed to have been 300 of them, and sometimes you think there was more, and sometimes they didn't see that many, because you know, what guns we had, we were firing. They were making quite a few passes and strafing a lot of ships, because before they got to us, that's when they went and got the Air Force, which I didn't know, you know. At the sub base, they fired on them. And then by that time, when they got to us, they knocked tail out of us, too. I thought they ruined our Navy, but they mostly sunk all the old battleships that they had not much use for at that time. The carriers, just the good Lord was notified us not to have any in there that morning. But the Enterprise was coming in. She was at sea, I don't know, not very far out, they said. They're on one side, here's Pearl, and the Japs are over here. And our planes couldn't probably go looking for them. I don't think they'd have went that far. They'd have found it, because when they got over with, they shagged for Japan. I guess they were on their way home. They probably were making knots.
When tell me again about how you and the Utah switched places.
The Utah, we came in November 27th,
uh-huh.
When the Utah was in our berth. And we usually tie up because we always have we were battleship cruiser repair. We took care of fixing them because the Medusa was the only ship that could rebore a 16-inch gun. When we got there, what are we going to do? Are we going to tell the Utah to get out? So we just went out to the first two buoys out there across from her and tied up between two buoys. And she had our berth. And we have a fresh water line coming from Fort Island that we didn't have to make water while we were in port. So we could just tie onto it and get water from the base there. And but she was in our berth, so we just stayed out. And the Curtis was tied up in front of us. And I think it was Detroit, the light cruiser. Detroit was tied up just ahead of the Utah. And then the Solis, which was the hospital ship, she was tied up about on the backside. And there was a couple other ships. I forget the names of them. They were in there. But there's two-man sub that come up, and it fired its torpedoes, and it missed the one that was next to the beach, like the Utah, and it landed on the beach, and the old Medusa put a shell through its conning tower. So we did get credit for one two-man sub, because it was about a month after they decided to bring it up, and they brought a barge there. But it tell you how it happened. This destroyer was going around the base there of Fort Island because they heard about the two-man sub. Mm-hmm. And when that two-man sub come up, the old, I forget the name of the destroyer, she dropped the depth charges on them. And when they picked it up, it looked like an accordion where all the ribs were on this two-man sub. Mm-hmm. We watched the whole thing. They got down there and picked it up. And then the other one that come up on a coal dock, if you remember, if they told you the story, it landed on the beach. And one there's an officer and an enlisted man. Well, they picked them up, and they finally mounted at the base, at the sub base. And then somebody got the idea, why didn't make a good tour thing? So they loaded it up and took it to the States and toured the United States with it. And my wife bought bonds and stuff. I don't know if she bought them prior to me marrying her, because I didn't marry till 43. They toured all the United States, toured it with that thing on a ship or something. They had probably a trailer. It wasn't very big. Them two-man subs are not very big. But they did mount it there at the sub base for a while, and they decided to bring it to the States.
Why do you think it's important that people always remember December 7th?
Well, just like we had the one that was 9-1-1, we remember Pearl Harbor, and here we remember 9-1-1. And nothing can happen in this country. We're always perfect, you know, and we're not. And right now, to my thinking, the world is against us. It's like we were top dogs for so long. Everybody respected us, but I don't think they do anymore. Everybody's mad at us now. You know, we went through all these three, four, five little wars that we went through. We never won one of them. The last war we won, was 1941. That war there, we won. And we stayed there for almost 4 years, and we beat them. But all the other ones, there's not one that's been won. If you know that, they're still fighting Korean War. They didn't win at Vietnam. Over there at Europe, no, this one here we're on now. And they went to, even they went down to Panama. They went down there, couldn't even win that little thing, Grenada. They didn't even win Grenada. I think we ought to just enforce ourselves, rebuild our forces, and people respect us. They know we have power.
What was the hardest thing for you that day, or at Pearl Harbor? Was it picking up the bodies? Was that a small
boat
you're in?
Well, that was my biggest sadness in my life, and it still bothers me today, because I didn't know, because they told us that there was just going to be a small percentage of that were there that morning, because at one time at Pearl Harbor before the war, there used to be 70,000 servicemen on the beach at one time on a weekend. And they're thinking, we don't know about how many people we had in the Navy, what ships we had in the Navy. We just saw what came in there. And when that happened, it kind of depressed me, you know, they're thinking, am I going to be one that's not going to come back? And seeing all that destruction, you know, all them battle wagons all laying on the bottom.
That's what Joe Quercia was trying to make sense of 84 years ago this weekend. It's time for our final break, but when we come back, memories from three more men who were there on that day of infamy. Hometown Heroes continues after this.
Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 84 years since the surprise attack on Oahu. All branches of the service were affected that day, including the Army Air Corps. Ed Hall was at Hickam Field that Sunday morning.
And then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside. I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue, Hangar 7 and 9. Had blown up and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire, and this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. But he had to pull up to miss the building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was. and I could see him. So then I went running out, hollering for Alex, where is everybody? Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided I got to hide someplace. Where, oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. And things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out, started yelling for Alex, and I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air and looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, cursed me out, you're going to get killed, get under here. And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the Hickwood, the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there, and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, it always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, stop, stop. I need you, I need you. I said, who are you? He said, I'm a medic. We got wounded. We got to get them to the hospital. So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars, picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a 45 automatic. I figured, well, his guts are spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his 45 and never cleaned that belt either. It still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck, and we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab that just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat. Not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out and went to shut the door, he says, my God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof. And I look at it, my Lord, where the... And then I realized the tires had been shot out and these dang-gone bullets came through the roof of the cab, number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron.
Ed Hall, remembering three of the 189 airmen killed at Hickam Field on December 7, 1941. Members of every branch of service were involved on that day of infamy. Francisco Paredes was in the Army, assigned to Schofield Barracks.
I was on my way to church for mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, this is not a drill, this is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's where everything went haywire. So I start picking up fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. I start pulling
bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads. And it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
More than 2,400 Americans were killed on Oahu on December 7th, 1941. And of course, nowhere were the losses more catastrophic than on Battleship Row, where the USS Arizona and the USS Oklahoma accounted for more than two-thirds of all the lives lost that day. I'm so grateful to have met Don Stratton. Don is no longer with us, but his account of what he endured aboard the battleship USS Arizona that morning on a day when 1,177 of his shipmates lost their lives is something I'll never forget, and I don't think you will either.
My battle station was a sight setter in the port and the aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremost.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before, but when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot of to do with the good Lord, I guess, and but we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line with that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and a small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burned like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
How did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number two turret went into a million pounds of ammunition and it blew up. That just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we're kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. Six of us went across there.
But I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You're just trying to get out of the way from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heaving line, which is a small line, and then tied on the heavier line, and it was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burnt. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion, or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt, and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who were on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach. And they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most certainly figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit and a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience. And
yeah, where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, they got to notice that I didn't make it, and then they got to notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm and kept the burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because I hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack. We headed for the South Pacific right away, and we were in on the invasion of the land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there, and we went to Guadalcanal and picked up troops to put in the Philippines, and the lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the minesweeps, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pickup patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that, and that you've told your story many times. So that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess. Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened. But that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes are still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live. It's just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so I was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and I went back in. Like I tell everybody had to be someplace, and I was there.
If you've never read Don Stratton's book, All the Gallant Men, you might want to put it on your Christmas list, or look for it in the gift shop next time you visit the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor. 84 years later, there are no remaining survivors from the Arizona, and only a handful who were there at all that Sunday morning. It won't be long until none of them are with us anymore. But their most compelling reason to share their stories with us was the hope of eternal vigilance, preventing this from ever happening again. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you can join us again next time, when we'll be reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.